Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to today's podcast. In today's segment, we have the honor of talking to Mr. Sam Crowther. He is the founder of Casada. It's a leading cybersecurity startup, and they originally come from Australia, but now they're based in New York. Sam, thanks for your time. Let's go ahead and get started, please.
Thank you for having me.
It's our honor and privilege. Thank you. Now, we looked up your bio. We didn't do like a background search or anything on you. Don't worry about that. But we kind of looked you up on LinkedIn. We did a little bit of Google searching, looked at your website. And at a very young age, I've got to really congratulate this for you. And I'm very impressed because I didn't start my thing till I was in my early 40s. You started very young in cybersecurity. Can you tell us some highlights of your career and that $7 million funding? I mean, that's so impressive at the age of, 24, I believe. Please tell us all these details if you can.
No, I appreciate it. Yes, 24 now. Well, I mean, honestly, there's been quite a few highlights. It's been a bit of a whirlwind. However, I think there are a few standout moments. One of the big ones, which was a real turning point for me personally, when I was much younger, sort of towards my later years of high school, I was fortunate enough to do some work with one of the signals intelligence agencies in Australia and, you know, work alongside some absolutely brilliant people, who were solving some national security problems. And that really got me incredibly excited about the industry and actually showed me there's a career in it because, you know, up until then I'd just been breaking little things here and there and not realizing it was a job. So that was definitely a very distinct turning point. And then after that, I started working for one of the big investment banks in Australia under a pretty awesome head of security who, you know, was unbelievably encouraging, as an 18-year-old fresh out of high school. And you think he personally really pushed me in a phenomenal direction to, you know, get to the point where I was ready to take the risk to start my own business. Looking back, I'd say those two events have really been formative for me and have, you know, been what's, I guess, given me the confidence to actually go and try something which, you know, could have failed very early on. And, you know, fortunately enough, didn't. But then, you know, some of the highlights since then, I mean, you know, Casada's been an absolute whirlwind. We've got some unbelievable investors. We've achieved things which, you know, I would never have thought possible at the age of 18 when we first started. And, you know, I think we're still on a trajectory of achieving more and more things, which I'm sure I, you know, can't even dream of yet and can only hope for.
Okay, excellent. Now, how did the idea for Casada come up? Was it something that you've started on your own or you've had other help? And how did you get the name Casada? What does it exactly mean and how does it relate to cybersecurity?
I actually got the idea from Casada out of problems I was facing. In previous jobs and at a current position back in that time, I actually just kept running up against the same problem. And that was, no matter what we did, someone could write a piece of code to perform a task against our website or our applications, right? And the problem was it just made so many attacks that previously were not a concern because they just weren't viable, all of a sudden incredibly viable. And a good example of that is, you know, credential stuffing or brute forcing, right? Where you have stolen credentials and you just hammer a website to see which ones work. And also content scraping. So we, you know, had a platform where research was published and, you know, people were scraping it and just taking it and we couldn't do anything about it. And so that's really where the inspiration to solve the problem came from, is there was just nothing that we could do. And, you know, I thought I had a pretty nifty idea to stop it and gave it a shot, and it turns out it works. Now, you know, where does the name Casada come from? Naming things is hard, and we spent quite a while trying to come up with a name. And we settled on Casada because it actually, I believe in Turkish means marriage. And the way we look at that is it's very much the marriage of security and usability. Like, we're really trying to change how people perceive, you know, enterprise security and how people actually interact with it from an organizational perspective, right? And become an experience that is, you know, very similar to that of an app they may use in their personal life. And then subsequently, from the end customer's perspective, right, security should be invisible. It shouldn't be the end user's problem to ensure that they're as secure as they can be, because the reality is that's just not their role. And that's where we really see our role. And that's why we, you know, settled on the name that we did.
Okay, awesome. Now, can you explain to us what your product exactly does? I mean, I'm looking at your website right now, and it seems like your company, Kasada, focuses mostly on bot detection. Am I correct?
Yeah, so look, at the end of the day, our product has one goal, and that's to ensure that humans get to your website, and subsequently, that means we can mitigate the risk of malicious automation. That's it. What we aim to do is ensure that the people interacting with your website are human. And that means that we can, you know, solve, a plethora of problems which manifest when someone has the ability to automate.
Okay. Now, can you explain to our audience what exactly is a bot? I mean, there are probably some people out there that have heard it, but what's like the more technical definition of it, or how can our audience relate to it that may not have heard of it before?
Yeah, now a bot or, you know, a robot is simply an application or a piece of code that is performing any sort of action that a human otherwise would, and that can be broken down into a few categories. You've got one that may be, you know, as simple as a curl script or a wget, where it is, you know, just sending a single payload to an application, right, to a website or a mobile API. But then you've got ones that are much more on the sophisticated end, where they may be, you know, fully automated browsers, which, you know, have some sort of web driver hooking into them to control them, to move their mouse, to type in, you know, usernames and passwords. But they all share the one thing in common, and that is there's no human driving it. And that's really what it comes down to, is a bot or a robot is merely something that's being driven by a computer versus an actual human.
Okay. And how does it actually lead to a malicious attack? I mean, if it's just going to your website, but where's the link between that and it actually deploying like a specific piece of malware? Can you elaborate on that too, please?
Yeah, so the problem with bots isn't necessarily the tools themselves or them at an individual level. The problem is what it enables an attacker to do. And if we take the example of brute forcing accounts, right, for someone to sit there manually typing usernames and passwords or copy and paste them, right, is too time consuming. Bots are dangerous because what they enable is an adversary to scale up their operation to, you know, huge volumes at very economical levels without having to lift a finger, right? So someone can take an attack that might seemingly be benign, like testing someone else's credentials, and scale it up to millions of attempts an hour. And, you know, all of a sudden, those 2 or 3% success rates become very, very dangerous numbers. That's what it comes down to, and that's why they cause so much damage, is because they enable one person to amplify their attack to the nth degree.
Okay, gotcha. Now, what are some examples of the industries that your product line fits into?
Yeah, so we work across a number of different industries, and what we do is relatively vertical agnostic because it's really about the company's online presence, right? So we work across energy, retail, hospitality, travel, and tech companies. And it's because the thing that they all have in common is that there's some sort of ability to exploit the applications or their websites or their apps that their customers use for financial gain. And you know, that unfortunately doesn't limit itself to a vertical, right? Because as all of these organizations are pushing their customers to move online and to engage with them through their digital channels, they all of a sudden are opening up all of these previously internal business processes, which you know are exploitable when you scale up some sort of automated attack.
Okay. Now, except for being in New York and in Australia, do you have a presence in other countries as well too?
Yeah, so we have customers out of the UK as well. And, you know, for now, the UK, Europe, US, and Australia are what we're focusing on. But you know, as soon as we're ready, the other major markets in the world will, you know, start to invest more in and work with companies there as well.
Okay, excellent. Now, who is your typical customer that you're trying to target? Is it the SMB or the larger companies like the Fortune 500, 100, or is it a mixed match of both, or basically whoever has a need for your service? Is that pretty much what it is? Or?
Yeah, so it wouldn't be a small business. Typically, the larger end of the medium scale to the enterprise is where we work. So, you know, our smaller customers probably do a few hundred million dollars a year in revenue, and our largest do many billions a year in revenue. That tends to be the sweet spot where, you know, they're at the size where they're big enough of a target for someone to invest the time in crafting one of these attacks against them.
Do you have any customer success stories you'd like to share with us, or like any case studies you can elaborate more on a general level?
Yeah, we do. So we actually work very closely with one of the big distributors for, you know, sort of mid to high end fashion. And, you know, they represent the likes of Coach, Lacoste, Ben Sherman, Nautica, the North Face. So that they had a lot of problems as they started to push the customers to buy their goods online, where, you know, they started getting hit with quite a lot of fraud on their websites, but it was all driven by these bots, right? Because it was just so much more economical for someone to use automation to test credit cards and try and commit fraud than to do it manually. So, you know, we started working with them a few years ago, and, you know, since going in line with them, we've actually almost completely mitigated those risks and those problems they were facing. You know, there's been no attacks since we went live with them and successfully exploiting these problems. This actually also had some knock-on effects, and one of the big ones was improving the website uptime, right? Because the website was no longer having to support all of this unnecessary traffic, right? It no longer crashed every time a big bot came to it. And then subsequently, because the synthetic traffic or the bot traffic was, creating or muddying the waters of their analytics, we actually improved their conversion rates by about 60%, purely because we were just able to remove all of the garbage that was, you know, making them or, you know, not enabling them to see clearly what their customers were doing.
Okay, excellent. Now let's get into your product and service line into a little bit more detail. It looks like that you have distinct lines in bot mitigation for web apps, APIs, and mobile, as well as web traffic analytics. Can you get into these in a little bit more detail? And how are they made available? Are they an on-prem solution that a client can just put in their local servers, or is it on the cloud like your AWS or Azure, or even both?
Yeah, so this is all a cloud-based solution. And that's really because it enables the most flexibility and the most performance out of the box. You know, we see that as the most advantageous to our customers, is going down that route. Now, when we separate the bot mitigation and the analytics component, right, when we look at ways in which, you know, a user or a bot can interact with an application, you have your traditional static websites, and then your more modern, I guess, mobile APIs and applications, and then, you know, APIs which may extend across both of these platforms and into others. And, you know, we really look at it as you need to be able to successfully mitigate risks on all the channels, you know, to actually deter people. And so that's why we focus on ensuring that, all right, if it's a website that's, you know, getting hit, that it is in fact a browser on the other end. If it's a, you know, mobile application hitting an API, that it's the right mobile app on a legitimate device. And then, you know, if it's an API getting hit, that the client on the other end of the API, whatever that may be, is in fact the legitimate client and is not some sort of bot that's been scripted to abuse the application. Then from the web traffic analytics, one of the things which, you know, we're able to do is provide very, very good insight into what's actually going on in your applications, right? Where people are targeting, where users are actually interacting with your website, and other sort of traffic trends. And this is a really big area for us, and where we want to invest more and more as we go forward is, you know, enabling our customers to extract as much value out of all the data that we collect as possible. And because we are, you know, sitting in this, you know, traffic flow for our customers, the amount of data that we collect is quite vast, and it enables us to paint a really accurate picture of, you know, how their applications are performing and, you know, what people are doing on their applications, which has a huge amount of business value to them.
Okay. Excellent. Now, I was wondering, just a side question here, do you use artificial intelligence, perhaps, or machine learning, neural networks in your product and service?
So at the moment, we're going on that journey, right? We didn't want to overcomplicate things at the beginning, and we realized you can actually do a very good job without a lot of those mechanisms at the start. But to get us to the next level, that's exactly what we're going to be doing. So we're actually investing in the technologies that will enable us to, you know, in real time build and then run ML models over the data that we collect to glean even more value from what we present to our customers.
Okay. Excellent. Now, can you tell us more about the technological architecture that you use for your product service lines? I'm at your website again, and it seems like you have a series of, I believe, 5 or 6 technologies, like going from client interrogation to client sensors, telemetry, and inferencing. Could you please elaborate those in a little bit more detail if you can?
Yeah, so our product can really be broken down into 3 main components when it comes to the detection. So as you mentioned, the first one is this client interrogation, right? So this is where we're all about proving that the client on the other end of that browser or that app is what they say they are, right? We want to ensure that they're a human. And the way we do this is through running what we call these client sensors. And so these are how we collect behavioral attributes from that browser or that app. And then what that enables us to do is send it to the back end and very, very quickly figure out whether or not it's a human driving the app or the browser. So that's the first component of what we do. The second component is this cryptographic challenge or this proof of work. And so what this is about is driving up the underlying cost of automation. But if we can enforce a very complex math problem, which scales exponentially with abuse, it all of a sudden introduced a very real cost barrier to entry. Because when these attacks are launched, they typically run on rented servers, be that AWS or, you know, some other cloud provider. And there's a cost to run them. Right? It's not free. And so if we can actually drive up the underlying cost to just get started, the idea is it just halts the attacks because it's too slow and it's just not economically viable. And then finally, the request modeling component. And so this is where we look at how particular clients are interacting with an application. Right? Are they doing things that look like bot behavior? Or, you know, are they pretending to be something that they're not when interacting with the application? And those 3 components or pillars, I guess, work very, very well together and what enable us to provide a very, very deep defense model for our customers and, you know, mitigate even some of the most sophisticated adversaries that we come across.
Okay. Now, I've noticed you also do what's called request modeling. Now, for example, I know that bots, you can capture a lot of information and data with bots. Now, do you offer what I call extrapolation services to your clients as well? Do you kind of help them project what's supposed to have been impacted by a bot? Do you help them project what the impact of these bots could do into the future if they don't do anything to remediate the problem?
Yes, that's part of, you know, the relationship that we like to establish with our customers is a very close feedback cycle where we both understand the impacts of these sort of attacks. And, you know, a very critical thing to that is really the security angle, you know, what could happen if an attack like this is successful, and then also the business continuity angle. Would this bring down my website, and what would that cost me in revenue? Those are, you know, those are two very important things for us to make sure we're on the same page with all of our customers about, because, you know, that's how we deliver, you know, the value that we do is that sort of very, very, you know, tight relationship with organizations we work with.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Kasada portal? Like how, what kind of information it displays and its ease of use for clients? Is it just like one dashboard, or will the client see multiple dashboards, or how does it work exactly?
Yeah, so the idea is, you know, a client only has one dashboard to worry about where they can do all perform all the analysis on all of the websites that we protect for them in the same screen. And it's really designed to be very, very simple, and, you know, to not burden them with any configuration. It's more about how they can glean insight from the data we collect. That's its purpose, right? And you know, most customers, you know, use some of the overview functionalities that we have where, you know, we actually enable them to look at patterns across all of their websites at once. But then, you know, when there's an attack, at the same time, we want to enable them to do a very, very deep dive investigation. And that's where we actually expose all of the, you know, HTTP traffic logs and let them query our system in real time.
Okay. Now, how exactly does a bot actually steal a username and password? Is it just like kind of like ransomware? How does that process exactly work?
No. So the way this typically works is every time there's a data breach of a website where, you know, usernames and passwords are leaked. So this happened to one of the big gaming media companies a few years ago. Happens, you know, all the time. These usernames and passwords end up in these pools, which, you know, an adversary will buy, knowing full well that there's a substantial percentage of the population that reuse usernames and passwords across multiple websites. So if all of a sudden I have access to a billion credentials, let's say, and let's assume that 3% of those credentials will work across multiple websites, what I will then do is pick maybe 15 or 20 websites with valuable information behind the login and set up a bot to hit all of them at once, testing every credential individually. And that's how they, I guess, get their hands on them and then glean the value from them. It's, you know, it's a proper marketplace, right? That's a part of a, you know, almost a, some sort of chain, right, where someone steals the credentials, someone buys them, and then puts them into their bots.
Okay. Now, another question about bots. What are the most number of attacks that you see? Are they on e-commerce sites or just normal business websites like how you and I have? Or how about the social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn? Out of these three, what's the proportion of bot attacks happening on these buckets? Or which one do you see has the most, or is the most prone to being attacked by a bot?
Yeah, so in our experience, we would say e-commerce applications or applications where customers transact with them. And that could mean buying goods, but it could also mean paying an electricity bill. Right, if we take the broader definition of e-commerce, those would definitely be hit the hardest and, you know, far more frequently than we would see in other verticals. And purely because there's just so much to gain from successfully exploiting and taking over customers' accounts or causing damage to these applications.
Okay. Now, I've got to ask you something. This is just your own opinion. I mean, do you see Facebook being hit with bots all the time? Because every day when I peruse the cyber headlines, Facebook is always coming out with some kind of data breach or something going on. Are these caused by bots primarily, or what's the impact of Facebook on this?
So it's a bit of a mix and match as to what's caused by bots on their end. I know they have some, you know, very sophisticated internal investments that they've made to build systems to help identify fake accounts and shut them down. But look, the reality is they're a very big organization, so they're a very good target for people to break into, either to collect a bug bounty or to be malicious and steal the data. I guess without specifics, it's hard to say which breaches are caused by bots versus, you know, humans on the other end.
Okay. Now, can you tell us how your solutions, your services, protect the APIs that are used from malicious automation attacks?
Yeah, so again, looking back at APIs, right, the more modern example is where you actually have a single API that services web clients and mobile clients and maybe some, you know, physical clients on desktop apps or whatnot. And again, the way we do that, and the approach that enables us to protect these is because we have the ability to verify that the browser on the end connecting to this API or the mobile app connecting to the API or the desktop app connecting to the API is a legitimate application that's being driven by a human. That's what enables us to actually protect them. Because again, similar to regular, you know, websites or regular mobile apps, the incentive for someone to exploit an API with automation is huge because the payoff's very big. And in the same way that, you know, we think about protecting other vectors, it's all about proving that there's a human driving the process that's connecting to the API.
Okay. Now, is there an increase in the rise of API security issues? Because I wrote a pretty lengthy article for a client a couple of weeks ago on API security. You know that OWASP has kind of come out with their top 10 vulnerabilities. In your professional opinion, what is the prevalence of API security flaws? Is it going to be a huge thing this year? Now, I know COVID ID is like the big, you know, dominant, you know, issue these days. But apart from that, what are your thoughts on this being attacked into?
Look, I think it'll be substantial. I think the reason it'll become more substantial is because APIs enable consolidation, right? But all of a sudden, you no longer have a separate website to a separate mobile app to a separate channel that a partner may use, right? It's all the one. And that inherently increases the attack surface because instead of attacks being spread across three distinct, interaction mechanisms, they're now on the one. So I do believe that's going to cause a substantial increase in attacks to APIs. And they have, you know, more value than ever, right? In the same way that websites are getting, you know, increasingly valuable to attack, APIs will, you know, continue on that journey as well, and probably at a greater rate because of the consolidation that's happening. So I think it's definitely going to be a very problem area that it needs to be very seriously thought about because, you know, people often forget that just because, you know, there's not a GUI in front of it, that someone can still exploit it just as easily as something with, you know, a GUI like an app or a website.
Okay, now I know that software developers, you know, when they're under, you know, when they want to stay under budget and they're in a time pressure to develop the project for the client, like a web app, they often make use of open source APIs. And I think very often these APIs are not really very well tested for security. And I don't think software developers really keep that as a high priority in their mind as they implement them. Now, there are a lot of backdoors left behind. Can a cyber attacker actually use these backdoors to launch e-skimming attacks against online stores?
Yeah, so it would depend what sort of APIs were being leveraged, but that's definitely a problem with the increased use of open source components, right, which, you know, have a very real possibility of being compromised by a malicious developer that contributes to them. It is a very real risk, and I think that sort of stems back into that, you know, idea of we need to make sure that software developers and engineers are, you know, conscious of the security aspects of what they're doing. Because, you know, whilst it may be very easy to include a little library that, you know, provides APIs to validate a credit card or something else, yeah, we need to think about, yeah, that what's the risk that this has been compromised, and how can I get assurance that it hasn't been?
Okay, excellent. Now, can you tell us about mobile security? You know, I mean, that's always been a hot button topic, you know, with, you know, malicious mobile apps being downloaded from Google, you know, Play and all that. You know, we've got now the work from home issues, you know, people using, you know, their own personal devices, which is called bring your own device. What are your thoughts on all that? I mean, do you see clients that request your help on this aspect too?
Yeah, so where we play into it is really ensuring that the app that a client owns, so let's say their e-commerce app, is in fact the application that's being driven by a human when someone's buying something or browsing, right? And that it's not a knockoff third-party app, or it's not a bot that is, you know, trying to circumvent all of the app security, I guess, that's been built in. I think that's, again, going to rise much more and more as a vector, because it's very simple for someone to develop attacks against a mobile API, right? The mobile APIs respond with content that is very easy for code to digest and understand. And so that inherently makes it easier to develop against maliciously. And, you know, to your point, I think that as the environment that we're in changes substantially and people have more time on their hands to invest in targeting these sort of endpoints and users of these apps, it's definitely going to become even more of a problem than it is today.
Okay. Now, tell us more about the PKI services, public key infrastructure. How is this made as a service, and can it be made on-prem in case a client does have a kind of IT infrastructure for their business?
Yeah, so we don't typically hold a customer certificate. We will avoid that at all costs. And, you know, purely for the reason is we don't want private key material in our system. And so we leverage our cloud providers' PKI infrastructure to ensure that, you know, we have a valid secure certificate that, you know, doesn't need to intrude on, you know, our customers' security processes, especially if they have some sort of, you know, HSM or other very sophisticated PKI infrastructure that is very difficult to work with. You know, we want to make that simpler for them and less of a security risk.
Now, you mentioned about product challenges, you know, the economics of launching automated attacks. Can you explain how all this works?
Yeah, so what it comes down to is really two main aspects. One of them is raising the bar, right? Raising the skill floor required to get started. You know, inherently, the more skill of an attacker that you require to launch an attack, right, the more that's going to cost and the longer it's going to take to get going. And that's an economic barrier in itself and a very deliberate one. Now, the subsequent one is that proof of work idea is, okay, if you want to launch one and you're that determined, sure, you know, you can have a go, but now you're going to be hit with compute overhead that is going to, you know, take up time, which inherently costs money in an attack. And it's those two aspects that work really well together to disincentivize people from, you know, even having a go, because it's just going to be too high of a barrier to entry from a cost and time perspective to get started, and there's so many other organizations that are cheaper to attack.
Okay, excellent. Now, why is it important to fight malicious automation with a solution that's dynamic?
Yeah, when we think about automation, you know, in the sense of everything from automated tests to, you know, even how cars are built, you know, in an automated factory, automation relies on the fact that something will remain the same, right? There will be consistency. And so by introducing a highly dynamic nature to what we do, it makes it unbelievably difficult to automate against, because you can't automate against something that you can't predict or that you don't know what the behavior is going to be. And again, it just adds that new layer of complexity, right, where someone may spend all of this effort automating against a particular behavior that they are seeing only for it to change completely just before they get to the finish line. And that's why it's so critical, is by constantly shifting the goalposts, you make it very, very difficult to create some sort of bot or piece of automation that can, you know, actually adapt with the goalposts changing.
Okay, excellent. Now, recently, and I didn't even know about this, that CAPTCHA was actually dumped. I mean, now CAPTCHA is like when you click that thing, that check mark where it says you're not a robot, and it comes up with those pictures like click here if you see a tree or sidewalk, am I correct? Why was
yep,
that dumped?
That's right.
I mean, I still see websites that do that, and what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, so I mean, Google haven't dumped it completely, but a lot of big vendors using it are. And I think there's a few reasons. One is it's very invasive. Ready to get back to my point earlier, good security shouldn't be visible to a user, but it should be very visible to an ad, like an attacker. And that's a big sticking point, right? There's been many studies shown how substantially something like a capture can reduce conversion rates just because it's so much friction. And there's so many people who just get fed up and go away. So I think that's a big part of it. And the second part is, again, it's very predictable. So there's many ways to automate around it. And now there's, you know, a plethora of services, which, you know, you can literally, you know, build straight into your bot that will bypass it completely. And so I think it's just gotten to a point where it's just not effective enough.
Okay. Now, as we wrap up our show, Sam, just the two last questions here. Now, what are your thoughts on the cyber threat landscape in general? I know that the COVID IDs I just talked about previously, that's making the news headlines right now. But other than that, what do you think is going to be like the biggest threat this year, probably going into next year? Is it going to be the bots, ransomware, phishing, attacks on critical infrastructure? Just like, it's just an open-ended question, but what are your professional thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, if we look at how, you know, COVID has changed our behaviors, right, where now all of a sudden everyone's remote, and that's forcing people to interact with businesses in very different ways. I think that, to me, is where we should start. And that, I guess, comes down to the individuals getting targeted more. So definitely an increase in, you know, attackers going after employees, exploiting the fact that they're working remotely. Right, but then subsequently, you know, adversaries taking advantage of now that e-commerce and digital channels are more valuable than ever. If I wanted to hold a company for ransom, right, it may actually be more practical to try and launch some sort of application denial of service attack against a website, you know, than it ever would have been, because now an organization's sole source of income is that site, right? And so I think that's what, you know, we're really going to see a shift in. We've already seen it from a bot perspective and how attackers have reacted even just in the last 2 months to some of our customers and have shifted their behaviors. And it's very clear that they're thinking along these lines where they now understand that the value of e-commerce applications and these digital channels is higher than ever, which means it's the right time for them to start to go after them. You know, as with everything, I do think that, you know, attacks on critical infrastructure and all that will continue as they have been. I think the real shift is going to be around, you know, how attackers are targeting employees and then exploiting the value of these digital channels to organizations.
Okay. Well, as we wrap up our show, Sam, do you have any final thoughts on how? No. What I'm trying to allude to is that, you know, we all are at risk of being a victim of cyber attack, whether we're individuals or businesses or what have you. The only thing we can do is how we can further mitigate that risk. Do you have a list of, like, a laundry list of precautionary things that you tell people what they can do to mitigate that risk? What do you normally tell your clients as to how they can try to prevent a victim of a cyber attack?
Yeah, so I think the top thing is understanding what needs to be secured and then looking at organizations who do a good job. That's what, you know, we always recommend, and I, you know, have recommended in previous roles, is, okay, who's doing a good job in this space? Who's not in the press for being breached constantly? And what are they doing that I can mimic in my organization? Those would definitely be the big things, because there's no point reinventing the wheel. But odds are another organization or another individual has solved the problems that you're trying to solve. And so you may as well do what they've done, implement it successfully, and then, you know, ensure that risk is, I guess, mitigated, so you can move on to, you know, solving problems that are more specific to your business.
Okay. Well, Sam, we thank you for your time this afternoon. We really appreciate it. I think we got a lot more valuable insight into what bots are. At least I did. Thanks again for your time.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. Take care.